The Two Stop In podcast series is inspired by the memory of the last surviving founder of the Australian Cinematographer Society, my friend, the late John Leake ACS. When he and his wife Marion retired from the film industry, they bought a little motel outside Sydney, and it became a tradition for cinematographers and other filmmakers to stop in and have relaxed conversations about the industry and the craft of cinematography. It earned the nickname of the Two Stop In. This series sets out to recapture the spirit of those conversations. But this time, we're inviting you to listen in.
The Two Stop In.
I'm Ben Allen. Welcome to The Two Stop In. Today I'm talking with Simon Raby, NZCS. Simon's an incredibly talented cinematographer, and he's had a very diverse career, shooting everything from very low-budget short films and features up to massive visual effects extravaganzas. Simon is also currently the president of the New Zealand Society of Cinematographers. Simon, welcome to the Two Stop In.
Thanks, Ben.
So you're president of the New Zealand Society of Cinematographers.
Yeah, so Richard Black was the president for 6 years, and I think the society has been formally going for about 10 years now. Richard needed to move on, and his career was getting in the way of him being a president. He needed to concentrate more on his work, so he asked me if I'd step in and take over, and I said foolishly said yes.
So for such a vibrant and strong industry that New Zealand has, it's one of the younger societies of cinematographers around the world.
Yeah.
Were you involved in the formation?
I was there at the inaugural meeting, right at the very beginning.
Wow.
In fact, I was the only one who bought a camera, so
you got the only
someone
record.
Said we should have a photograph of us all here at the beginning. So, unfortunately, I had my camera there, and that was my kind of first impression on the society, was to actually take a photograph of everyone there.
And how's it been developing since then?
It seemed to go on leaps and bounds. Actually, we've had 3 years of awards now, so we have the NZCS Awards every year where we honour and look at members' works. And this is the first time, October 18 was the first time I was able to attend. So it was in my capacity as president as well, because I became president in August. So it was really exciting being able to go along, and actually I didn't realise what a kind of big event it was. It really was a beautifully laid on event that was, really classy, in a really beautiful place called Heritage, which is going now, unfortunately. It's changing. It's turning into apartments instead of being a venue. So we're shifting venues this year. But, it was, and it's beautifully laid on. It's a black tie event, and everyone turns up flash.
That's right.
We get to see clips of members' works, and it's a really nice chance to network and really sort of honour the sort of great work that's going on in New Zealand.
That's brilliant. And those sort of events, they're so valuable in terms of that networking and celebrating the craft and all that.
I think so. And also, we have a student film segment as well. So we're really interested in encouraging, young DOPs to be involved as well, as well as serving, as well as looking after our established members.
Yeah. I know for me, when I started attending the ACS Awards, when I was still kind of working in regional television, and it kind of opened up this huge world of possibilities and aspirational stuff, and provided the connections with people to kind of step into that world. And it was... I think it's a really powerful thing, particularly for people who are at that stage of their career.
It's really, a lot of people think of cinematography as being a slightly rarefied place, but in actual fact, there's all sorts of stratas, and there's people doing web series, and people doing documentaries, and people doing like television dramas, and we kind of want to be inclusive on all of that. We don't want to be just this kind of feature film kind of level. Yeah, I don't think there's enough feature film level area going on anyway, just to sustain the awards. But it's like having that broad spectrum of talent, we would like to recognise that, when you've got the news section, you recognise this one-person shooter who's doing incredible work by themselves in an afternoon, and that work is, equally as valid as someone who's got a large team of people trying to do high-end stuff. So
yeah, and I think it's one of the things that the ACS made the decision a long, long time ago, a long time before I was involved, that it would be an inclusive organisation of all these different aspects of cinematography, like the NZCS is. And I think it's an incredibly valuable thing for the organisation, for those reasons that you do have people doing amazing work in areas like news and current affairs and documentaries, and it's great. I think there's a great cross-pollination of ideas that can happen, where you get the top people in those fields talking to the top people in features and commercials, and And there's a real two-way flow of information. It's not just one direction.
Mm. It's one of the core principles of the NZCS is to share knowledge amongst our members, to freely distribute information and to have, create a focus point for... Because DOP is working independently all the time, right? Like, how often do you get to work with another DOP on set? It's like never.
Yeah.
There's usually a single HOD. Mm. And so it's kind of not a lonely position, but it's this place where you're not being fed from other people. So to have a place or a focus where people can get together and share ideas, I think is really valuable.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's not like, you're giving away trade secrets. It's like learning how to use the tools of your trade in ways that you might not have thought of before. So it's like, a painter can teach you how to use a brush in certain ways, but it doesn't mean to say you're going to copy their style.
That's right, yeah, yeah. And I think there's a wonderful tradition of that in cinematography, of that sharing of ideas and around the world.
Yeah, when I was younger, I used to love American Cinematographer magazine. So, you pick it up, the colour photographs. And for me, it was just like, oh, my God, this is what they're doing to create this look.
Yeah.
I was so fascinated when I found out, on the first Sherlock Holmes films that Russo was using China balls to light the whole damn thing.
Yeah.
And I was like, what? He's using China balls? And it's like, It's such a low-fi idea that worked so brilliantly that I was really excited that it's, I love the humanness of, DOPs are a certain breed of people that they're highly creative, but they're also highly intuitive, but they're also technical. So there's this kind of strange combination of creative and technical coming together.
It's really the collision point of the creative and the technical, isn't it?
Yeah, but bound into this strange space of stress and time pressure and money, where you've got these people who are thinking about the money, kind of pushing you into a space where you're having to work quite quickly.
Mm.
And, it's interesting, being creative under pressure with a bunch of people is often a really exciting thing to do.
It is, yeah. And when it really works, it's the most satisfying and exciting.
When it sings, it really sings, And, it can be really terrible as well, but usually when everyone's on the same page, it's a really, it's one of the most exciting creative forms to work in.
Definitely. Now, you've just done quite a big film, Mortal Engines.
That's right, yeah.
And so that was mostly on green screen?
Yeah, it was a stage-bound film. It's set 2,000 years in the future, so it was very difficult to find locations that worked for that.
Strangely enough.
And also it was set in Europe, and it was a New Zealand-based shoot.
Yep.
I think there was like one shot in the film, two shots in the film that had actually live plates. One is at the very beginning of the film when Hester's standing on the hill looking through her telescope at London coming. Mm. And we shot that on the hill behind the stage in Wellington. In fact, if I'd panned, if the camera had gone 10 degrees to the right, you would have seen the aeroplanes coming in and taking off. It was like it was right next to the airport. And it was just like they were trying to save money on it. It was just a sky shot, so why not use a real sky rather than have to comp a sky in?
Yeah.
And there was another shot that was, I think it was Valentine has an airship that he flies. In one of the flashbacks, he flies across the ocean and lands on the ground, and they shot that down. They shot the background plates in the west coast of the South Island.
Right, and you've done a lot of second unit and VFX work over the years, haven't you? So I guess that would have been a fairly comfortable place to be working, with basically every shot being VFX.
Yeah, I'm pretty familiar. I mean, I started at, my first big VFX film was probably Lord of the Rings, so it's a big sort of project to sort of dropped on the deep end on that one, because I was sort of never really worked on big stages before, so I learned a lot. Andrew Lesney was obviously the main DOP on that, and I was doing Unit 2A, which is so, kind of like big battle unit, if you like.
Right. So what was that like working with Andrew?
Andrew was, he was a terrific mentor. He was a really great guy. He had a lovely sense of humour, and he was very free with his, very free with information. So he was terrific. I didn't get to see Andrew as much as I would have liked. I usually got to see him at rushes in the evenings, and occasionally we'd mix on sets, but mostly we were on different stages in different places. So most of the information I got from him was at rushes, and he was always very encouraging. And, he taught me a lot about, very early on, he sort of said to me, do you remember this is a big film? And it's not as kind of, you don't have as much control as you would ever an independent film. You can't get really fussy with little cutters and C-stands because there's a bunch of actors standing around watching you work, and you've got to be ready to go. So he taught me a lot about how to pre-light a set, a stage, so that you could adapt very quickly to a turnaround or very quickly to a change, so that you weren't keeping the production waiting while you were trying to reset up lights.
Yeah, and I think it's interesting that, like, I think a lot of us, I certainly remember thinking this, that it's such a struggle on low budget stuff, and then you must have so much freedom on a big budget film, but it's kind of the reverse in reality.
It kind of is, yeah. There's a lot more financial pressures, there's a lot more people watching what you're doing, and there's a lot more emphasis on other departments, like or acting, for instance, you know, the actors, for instance, yeah, there's a lot more, you know, the actors kind of tend to...
If you've got big stars there, you don't want them hanging around.
That's right. The big stars are there and they just want to get on with it. So you kind of got to... It's all about prep. It's about having your preparation in place and being ready when you say you're ready. Mm. And I learned a lot about being really accurate with my prep times from Kara Cunningham, who was the first AD on Rings, and she was also first on Mortal.
Oh, wow.
And on Rings, you know, she was really emphatic. If I said I needed half an hour, at half an hour, she was turning over. And, you know, I learned to be really... It was like it's only fair and polite to give ADs a really accurate sense of how long you're going to be. And when you're a young DP, you sort of want to please them, so you're saying less time than you really need. But you can't really bargain for more time on a big shoot, so you've got to be right on the money. And it doesn't matter if it takes a long time. You know, the AD just wants to be
as
accurate,
they
so they can say makeup, wardrobe, art department, all those things. They've got this much time before we're going to be ready.
Yeah.
And if you can be accurate about that, it's big brownie points. So
it's kind of having the army marching all together.
Absolutely, absolutely. Yeah. And it's sort of, so now I feel like I'm much better at my times. I know I've learned really, I learned really quickly that being accurate with your times was of the essence.
Yeah, big part of the job.
Yeah.
Now, you mentioned Russia's screening on Lord of the Rings. Mm. Is that something that's still happening on the films that you've been doing since then?
Not really. Since everything went to the digital, we tend to look at Russia's online. So you'll have a secure server where you'll be able to access your Russia's and the main units, you know, the other units' Russia's.
Yeah.
Lord of the Rings, everyone would get together in the Russia's suite in the evening. And in some ways, that was really nice because you had all the meeting of the heads of department would come and sit and watch the Russia's together. And, Rings, you know, you'd usually get... it was interesting because the miniatures unit would turn out like 30 seconds of rushes for the day because it was very specific. Main unit would be doing an hour and B unit would be an hour. And on Lord of the Rings, I was working with Jeff Murphy, who was a veteran, very famous veteran director from New Zealand. But he would only print the takes he liked from the second unit. Yep. So even though we were a very big unit with big battles, our rushes would be relatively short by comparison. Which I found a little bit... You know, I was like a little bit, oh, crikey, we're not shooting as much as the rest of the team, as the other units.
Slacking off.
But in actual fact, we were shooting just as much, but just not printing as much. And the editors tended to like us quite a bit because they were only presenting them with, they didn't have to wade through so much footage to get to the good stuff,
I think it is something that has happened with digital, both the loss of the Russia screening as a team thing.
Yeah.
But also the temptation to shoot more and therefore... the loss of the print take in a lot of situations. And so the editors do kind of get quite overwhelmed with the amount of material coming in.
Yeah, I think there is a lot of that. But at the same time, it gives a lot of freedom for directors.
Yes.
Because, I mean, you know, some directors, they don't like the stop-start process. And as soon as you cut and you use the whole process of getting everyone ready again and getting your board in, it sort of breaks the mood up a bit sometimes.
Yep.
So
yep.
some directors really like just to keep rolling because it's a small price to pay for keeping everyone in the flow.
Yep.
So it's a two-way street, really. You know, you know, on film we used to worry about ratio so much, you know. And I remember, I think my first film I ever shot, which was with Nicky Caro back in, you know, the early 90s, and it was like, you know, we had a 3-to-1 ratio.
Wow.
Which was just enough time for a take in the board, really, And then three setups or two setups. So it was really tight. So, and then, you know, in drama it was like 12-to-1. So it was still always really tight. You were always like just doing just the take. And then.
Yeah. And no one would dream of doing 3-to-1. No,
it's 50-to-1 now. Yeah. You know, it's like it's a totally different regime. So it does make it harder for the editors, but it gives the directors much more freedom. And it means that you're free to also capture spontaneous things on set too, which is quite nice. You know, sometimes something is happening and you just grab it. And it's a good thing because it gives you the director more material to work with later.
Mm. So what cameras and lenses were you using on Mortal Engines?
We were using the Red Weapon 8K Helium chip, and we had Ultra Primes and Master Primes.
Mm-hmm. Nice lenses.
Yeah, they're really nice lenses. I think we worked with the Ultra Primes a bit more. They were slightly lighter lenses. So like when we had the Movi, we had a Movi rig and a Maxima rig, and we had a 50-foot Techno and a 30-foot Techno and a 15-foot mini sort of jib Techno. And, you know, we kept a body permanently in the Movi rig and the Maxima rig for, so we generally use the Ultra Primes because they're lighter, made the rig a bit lighter. I pulled the Master Primes out a fair bit, but actually we probably shot, I'd say, half, you know, most of the film on Ultra Primes.
Yeah, great.
Working about 1/2 to 8/4, I think, was the basic stock we were using a lot.
And so with the kind of areas that you were working with and the green screen element, that would have required quite a bit of light.
Yeah, you know, that there's this thing where there's a lot of flexibility that's required for visual effects, and there's a lot of flexibility. They like to have a lot of flexibility in post for the grade. So there's some, you know, because they're constantly refining and improving and refining and improving. That process doesn't stop with the script. You know, they're always trying to, you know, and there's the film you write and the film you shoot and the film you cut. It's kind of the three different films. And in the cutting process, you often find that, okay, this dialogue works better here, this would be better as this kind of scene. So they're looking for flexibility with the footage so that they can change the mood of it if they want to later on. So we had this ethic where we were always trying to provide a really fat negative. So if there were really black shadows, we'd always make sure there was some light in the shadows so that you could lift it if you wanted to change the shift the mood a little bit if the script, if the structure of the film demanded it. So we were always pouring quite a bit of light in to make sure our shadows were, there was always something we could lift out of it if we wanted to find it later on. And then we get the colorist on set just to wind the whole thing down so it sat in a true place shadow-wise.
Mm. So what was your process on set with determining exposure and monitoring?
Yeah, so I'm working with calibrated monitors. I've got a DIT next to me, and they're setting out. We had a LUT that was set up by post-production, so they gave us a particular LUT that was quite a strong LUT. It was quite a contrasty LUT because they were keen to make sure that I was not letting the shadows get too low, not getting
so it was really crushing the shadows quite.
Yeah, so that I had to put quite a bit of light in order to bring the shadows up to our normal levels because we wanted to have that flexibility later on to be able to find information in the shadows. So, I would light quite high key. I'd probably light for 5.6, but I'd be exposing for half to 8.4. So I'd be overexposing everything by a stop and a half really, and then bringing it all down. So we knew there was plenty of room in the bottom end.
Wow.
So I had a colorist on set, Damien McDonald, and he was my sort of on set DIT, so we'd work with the LUT that we'd been provided by post, and then we would alter that according to what the vibe of the scene would be. So actually right at the beginning of the film, we decided that rather than have a consistent look throughout the film, that each location would have its own look.
Great.
So the film has a sort of journey of looks right through it, because there are some very specific places that are quite different from each other, which was great because it gave me a lot of freedom to have a play, and it meant also that the audience wasn't being fatigued by a constant look all the way through.
And so those on-set decisions and grading decisions flowed through to editorial?
Yeah. So the LUTs would be sort of not baked into the footage, but they'd be there as metadata, and the editorial would use that. And so the director was looking at the same material in the same way that they were on set.
That's great.
And it's interesting because, you know, you get used to a certain look when you're in editorial, so by the time you get to the end of the film, you're used to it in a way that you like it, that you don't want to actually change it too much. But there was quite a big look development process that took place sort of in mid sort of 2018.
So that was after the shoot?
Yeah, so the shoot took place from sort of March to June, July 2017. And then there was a couple of weeks of pickups in sort of February of 2018.
Yep.
And then they they've been doing visual effects for like a year at that point. And then around mid-year 2018, we were getting together again for look development to have a play with those looks and just refine them so they were fitting better in with the story. And it also helped to guide us in a direction so that we weren't trying to make decisions about which way we were going to go. We had a clear idea from the director and producers about which way they wanted to go look-wise with certain scenes. So then when we got the final grade happening, it was more of a matching process to what we'd already decided on in the look development. Because by that stage, there were a lot of visual effects work pouring in, and there's quite a lot of grading work involved in the visual effects process, because you're not dealing with individual layers, but you're dealing with matte layers. So you're trying to enhance visual effects are doing great work with making it all work a balance, and we're just doing little enhancements to make things sit within that comp really well.
That's a fantastic process, isn't it, having those mats to be able to separate out the background and foreground layers and
really useful in the grading process, because it gives you a huge amount of flexibility.
And how involved were you in the final grade?
I was there all the time. So I was there.
It makes such a difference, doesn't it?
Well, you know, because it was, you know, a lot of visual post-production work still happening at the final grade, and visual effects were still being done. The director was really busy. So I was his eyes in the suite, and we'd already done look developments, and he was trusting me and Damien to do the bulk of the work. And he'd come in several times a week to look at what we were doing, but basically leaving us to it to do the work because he'd already pre-approved some of the looks.
And so to what extent were you using – I mean, one of the things I find really exciting about digital grading is the extent now to which we can go in and just finesse little details and things like eyes, but also adding shading to areas that would just take a long time to add shading to on set that you can do so quickly.
That's exactly, you just exactly said it. It's like, no, on
so
set.
So were you using a lot of those tools in the final grade?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I've done quite a lot of digital grading before, so I kind of knew the flexibility. We were working with Mystica in post, yep. And it's a really flexible tool. And it has great tracking abilities. So, you know, you can have a camera that's wildly moving around and you can create a shape in the frame and that shape will get tracked around. You know, it'll find objects to look at within the frame and it'll say, well, you belong over here, you belong here. So,
and it's wonderful how easy that stuff is now. It's not that long ago when it was, okay, well, we're going to need to track that mask, so let's go have lunch and then we'll come back.
That's right, yeah. Well, we had a team. It was quite a small team for the size shoot it was, but we had a couple of one person who was dedicated to doing sort of certain shapes for us. So, you know, that we knew that even though I was doing a lot of work on set to light eyes and make sure faces were really balanced, there were times when we wanted to enhance the eyes a little bit. So we kind of knew emotionally in the script where those scenes were likely to be. So we'd send someone off and they'd go and track eyes and create shapes for eyes for us for certain scenes. So when the producers and director came in and wanted to have a little play with the eyes, because you kind of knew they were going to say, can we just like zing them a little bit for this scene? We go, okay. And we had the shape ready and we would just
turn it on.
To lift the eyes or bring the eyes down or whatever it is we wanted to do for that particular scene.
And how fine was that tracking? Was it just a kind of a rough shape around the eye with a bit of softness there?
There was a bit of a debate about, you know, how fine we were going to get with the eyes. And, you know, at the beginning I was quite keen on like being really accurate and really fine lines with the whites of the eyes as opposed to the irises. Occasionally we did whites and irises.
Right,
but sometimes we just did pandas, what we call pandas, where we did a rough shape around the orbit itself.
It's amazing how often that works, isn't it?
Yeah. When you have a soft edge, you're going to increase the sharpness or the softness of the edge, so you're feathering the panda out, so it becomes really subtle, a really subtle effect. Of course, if you push it too far, it starts to look artificial, and you get vampire eyes, and you get that sense of like, wow, that's looking like a photograph from 1910. You know, it's like, whoa, it gets a bit scary. So there's a real fine line about how far you can push those things before it gets a bit unreal.
But being able to be there and go back and forth on it and maybe push it too far and then pull it back. It's a wonderful process.
It was a real privilege for me to be able to follow that right through, because I know, you know, there's a lot of times as a DOP when you're off on another job and you don't have the ability to be in the suite.
Yep.
And for me it was great being able to sit there in the suite and actually sort of try and get the film to where I imagined it when I first shot it.
Mm-hmm. Make sure it's all really cohesive.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and some of the ideas I had on set were a little bit crude. You know, there were some things I was doing where I was doing washes of colour that may be a bit much.
Mm.
And we got a chance to finesse that and get some more naturalism into the colours in post. So, you know, I was finessing the idea that I was playing with on set into a place that was much more sort of refined or a bit more subtle, if you like.
Yeah. And what was the process of working with VFX like, both in terms of the shoot and in the grade?
The VFX guys on that show, you know, are like second to none. I mean, they're really, you got top guys there. And I was working with a chap called Ken McGaw and a guy called Kevin Smith quite a bit, who are both really top VFX supervisors. And one or the other was always on set when there was big VFX stuff going on, which was pretty much all the time. and they were very, you know, effects have come a long way. So they gave me a lot of leeway with the visual effects. Really, they would say, you know, rarely would they try and restrict me from doing something. Like, everything is sort of, you can go in the shoulder, you can go handheld, it's all kind of free movement now.
Wow.
Most of the issues were really around Atmos and green screen.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, sometimes we go, okay, we'll let VFX do the Atmos. Sometimes we'd run it clean. There were a couple of times when I fought really hard to do Atmos. And there was a particular scene in Airhaven where there's a nighttime scene where everything's burning. And we were trying to do a lot of the effects in that with practical lighting and wind machines and debris and that sort of thing. And, you know, I know I wanted, because it was a big burning scene, so we wanted quite a bit of Atmos in the scene. And, you know, the VFX guys were going, let's shoot it clean and we'll put the Atmos in later. I'm going, oh, you know, I kind of fought a little bit for, like, you know, I don't think the lights are going to really kind of sell the effect so much, you know, in terms
without
of blooming
the
without the Atmos in there. So, and so they said, well, you know, what about the green screen? So I said, well, let's do some tests and see, because I was worried that the green screen was going to like spill all over the Atmos. Yeah. And sure enough, as soon as he lit the green screen up, there's all this like weird bleeding of green into the orange that we were doing with the firelight and stuff. So it was really, you know, we really quickly realized that it wasn't going to work as a green screen in an Atmos. So we tried a couple of other things out. We tried a black screen and a white screen. These are all suggestions coming from the VFX guys. So the VFX guys were quite open to what I was trying to do. And they said, okay, we understand what you're trying to do here. And so we tried, we did tests with green screen, white screen and black screen. And in the end, we decided to go with the white screen because it allowed us to kind of create this sort of dense kind of Atmos that fell away into darkness but didn't fall away into blackness.
Mm.
So it created this deep grey that they could work with, or deep orange, if you like, because I was using a lot of orange light. And then they were happy with that, and they said, well, we can work with putting objects into that space.
Wow.
And that was really great. And when you see the final film, you go, actually, 90% of that is just practical lighting and wind and debris effects, and there's a few sparks and a little bit of flames in there. But actually, in some ways, it took some of the heat off the effects for that, because we could do practically what, you know, they didn't have to do quite so much work to try and create the sense of flames.
Yeah, probably saved them quite a lot of hours.
It's possible. I mean, I'd like to think so.
So how are you doing those flame effects?
Well, we were working a lot with, we had an array of LEDs on the set. So our primary workhorse was the Arri Sky panels. So we were working with S60s, was our kind of workhorse light. We had some S120s as well for sort of broader software work, and a couple of S30s. And we were also working with Digital Sputniks with the DS6s and the DS3s. And they were kind of slightly punchier lights with quite strong chroma ability. So, whereas the S60s were really useful for, doing general modelling on actors and that sort of work, we found that the DS6s had the kind of strong colour punch for colour effect work. So my board op, Glenn Bielenberg, who's a really great Aussie board op, he was over and he was very quickly programming flame effects into the DS6s. And we were just punching them through cloth and punching them through smoke. And, and we'd have some set aside for explosions, so they'd punch right up for explosions. And some we just had flicker patterns running all the time. And I had like rows of softboxes of S60s, which I pulled the diff off so we could run flicker patterns on the S60s. So everything was in motion and everything was moving.
It's a very, very effective
coupled with, it was kind of helped by the fact that we had wind machines blowing all the cloth around, so the cloth was flickering and fluttering. So with all the DS6s punching through all this flickering, fluttering cloth, it kind of looked like flames in the background.
Yeah,
so it was worked really well. And then there's debris. And, occasionally VFX added a few flames for wide shots and things, and little sparks would come through occasionally. But it was quite subtle, and I think a lot of what was there was what we shot on the day, with no flames at all. We had no flame bars on set.
Wow, that's fantastic. Just jumping back to the atmosphere, when they did add that in post, is that something that you, knowing what it was, could pick?
It was pretty effective. I don't know that they had to do it a lot.
Yeah.
There was one scene we did in St. Paul's, which was a pickup scene, which was pretty much shot just against green screen. We did build St. Paul's in the studio. We shot the film at Stone Street in Wellington, in Miramar, and one of the biggest stages there is K Stage, which was named after Kong. They built the stage for King Kong, and it's a huge stage. And they built the interior of St. Paul's Cathedral, recreated St. Paul's Cathedral inside this giant K Stage. Wow. And it was this massive pillars, and the whole set was built almost pretty much out to the walls of the stage. So it was like it was a really big set. But there was a scene we did in St. Paul's that we did in pickups after the set had been deconstructed and gone. And we actually had to, it was actually a digital reconstruction of St. Paul's. And they put digital Atmos in there with like shafts of sunlight coming through, and it was actually really bang on the money. I'd set up some bounces of HMIs off the floor to give the sense of that sunlight bouncing off the floor for the actors in the foreground, but really I had no control over what posts were going to do with the background. And I thought it was a brilliant job. I thought they did an amazing job of recreating St. Paul's in a digital space.
Fantastic. And what was that working process like with VFX in post when you were into the grade? You were getting the mats for the different layers from them.
Yeah, so we got they would provide. I mean, visual effects were doing the bulk of the work. They were doing pretty much. They would provide us with a fully comped frame. Which was one layer, just the actual frame itself. Because to provide us with multiple layers of imagery was going to be very, very data intensive and very time consuming. So they just gave us the actual final comped frame. And then they gave us the mat layers for the
It's a really efficient way
elements.
Of doing it.
It is a really efficient way of doing it. Sometimes they get a bit nervous because they've spent a lot of time and care trying to get it right, and then someone else is going to mess with that shot. And so we were trying to be very respectful in that process. We weren't trying to mess with their stuff. We were just trying to enhance some of the things they were doing.
Yeah, because there is an element of trust there.
Absolutely.
In them doing that. They're trusting you not to mess it up.
That's right. And it's easy to go off beam. And and the director was quite clear with us too, that it was like, VFX have done a beautiful job here and I'm really happy with the way this looks. We don't need to reinvent this shot. We just want to, a tweak here and a tweak there and a little hint there. And we didn't really have time to reinvent what was going on because we had a tight schedule and we were trying to get the film out in time for its release.
Yeah. And I guess that's one of the other things about a big film like that, the there's zero flexibility on the release date.
Yeah, it's all pinned down, exactly. Yeah. And everyone works really hard to do the best possible job they can in the time frame. And I think that, I don't know anyone in that film who wasn't totally dedicated to the process of doing the best possible work they could.
Yeah.
I know there were some pretty big hours going towards the end there to get it as sweet as it could be.
Yeah, yeah. There's a great sense of collaboration when you've got that kind of dedication right across the team, isn't there?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I thought it was an amazing team of people working on that show. They're all A-class, professionals. And the great thing about working with really skilled professionals is they're actually a little bit more, not relaxed, but the word is they're a little bit easier to work with in terms of personality because they're already in a place where they know what they're doing. They're
not trying to prove themselves.
They're not trying to prove themselves, not coming from a place of uncertainty. The only pressure is the pressure of time and excellence. And, those are the pressures you want, excellence for sure.
So what do you think are the big issues facing cinematographers in kind of the coming years?
One of the huge challenges that cinematographers faced in the last 15 years was the switch from film to digital. And that was a big shift, and we've seen the technology come a long way since digital's been around. And, I love digital. I think it's a really flexible medium. I used to shoot on film a lot, and I do love film as well. But personally, I like the flexibility of digital over the romance of film. And I think that the mediums are so close now that some people love the romance of film, but I've struggled to spot the difference sometimes if you're doing it right with digital.
Yep.
I do worry about, people's obsession with that 4K that 4K look. And, I see a lot of TV work now that looks incredibly sharp, and I feel like it feels a bit too sharp sometimes and a little bit too kind of crisp.
Yeah.
And I feel like it's starting to feel a bit more video than it used to. And my feeling is always to try and take the sharpness out a little bit and soften the whole thing down. And also with HDR, there's a temptation to use the full range of all the whites and all the blacks. And again, that contrast becomes very extreme. And
Turn it up to 11 all the time.
Yeah, it starts to look a bit video-y. So my feeling is always like bring the whites back. Just don't sit them right at the top. And then bring them back to a place where it feels like to my eye a bit more natural.
Yeah.
Maybe I'm just an old fogey, but I kind of like things to look cinematic, and my instinct is always to try and get back to my sense of what I think cinema should look like.
I remember when I was working in regional TV at the start of my career, and at one point I was doing some online editing, and we'd sometimes get these EPK electronic press kits in for films that were about to open, and I used to love looking at them on the waveform monitors because we were always expected everything had to be bright, they had to be white whites, and I'd look at these big, beautiful films on the waveform monitor and realise that they were just going up towards white a lot of the time, but they weren't kind of bang, 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 the whole
exactly. You might get the odd spike, but everything's sitting down in 20%.
Yeah.
Often you're sitting between like 3% and like 30%.
Yeah.
I remember when I first started in video and I was doing my early lighting jobs, and there was a nighttime scene I was doing in a bedroom, and I'd lit it in a way that I thought was a really moody nighttime look, and my technical director was going, "This isn't right, you've got to put more light in here." And I'm going, "What are you talking about?" And he says, "Well, look, there's nothing's hitting a vault." And I'm going, "It's nighttime, dude. It's supposed to be dark." And he's going, "But this isn't technically accurate." And I'm going, "I just wanted to go get a life, like, really, I'm not making a film for technical perfection. I'm making a film for an aesthetic sense."
Yeah.
And there's that tension a lot between, in video anyway, there used to be this tension around, you got to keep it bright and you got to keep it everything in a place where you can see everything. Yeah, and I think that kind of takes the magic out of cinema. Sometimes you don't want to see what's going on.
Yeah.
And I think that's really valuable not to see what's going on. Film's more about shadows than it is about light.
And I think there's, I guess in the grand scheme of things, a fairly rapid progression, but it felt like a slow progression to people kind of realising actually most of the same rules still apply.
Oh, all the same rules still apply. Yeah, it's all the same stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, there's different tech at the post end, and there's different, it's changed a lot in terms of the flexibility that a DOP has now with LUTs, for instance.
Yeah.
Like once upon a time, we used to choose a film for its, we used to choose stock, right? Yeah. We'd go, okay, what sort of stock do we want to use for this film? And the differences were relatively subtle. You get slightly different color balances from Fuji to Kodak. Yeah. Kodak was known for its really bold reds and its blues, and Fuji was known for its kind of creamy softness. And so these days I kind of choose camera bodies in the same sort of way. I go, okay, is this a red job? Is this an Alexa job? Is this like a Sony job? This is a Canon job, and I find that I've gravitate more towards Sony and Canon cameras for documentaries, for instance. But that's more for the ergonomics of one person shooter on the shoulder, move it around. I don't have a lot of moving parts that I got to put together. I can pick up the camera already built and run
turn
with
it on
it.
And go.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Yep.
I work with both Red and Alexa, and they both have different looks. But
so, what sort of things are kind of drawing your eye at to the Alexa look or the Red look that you noticed there?
You know, that's a good question. It's like sometimes it's budgetary. You know, there's some budgetary considerations as well. I mean, I find the Reds generally, I mean, they really put out really beautiful pictures, but they generally tended to be a little bit more contrasty and a little bit more gritty, a little bit noisier in the bottom end than the Alexas.
Yep.
Alexas tend to be really creamy and really kind of they have this really rich, creamy feeling to them.
Mm.
And that's not always right for a job either.
Yeah,
it's not what you always want. So
sometimes you need something a bit
more
punchy.
Exactly, exactly. So, you know, I shot District 9 on when I was doing second unit. DP directing on District 9, we were using the Red 1 for that. It was Bill 15.
Wow.
And I think that was maybe the first feature film that was shot on a, you know, it was shot entirely on the, you know, a Red camera, on digital camera.
Wow. And
so.
And that was your first film on digital?
That was my first digital movie, yeah. So, and that was before they had the sound card and,
wow.
and the Red, you know, but it was a great build, a really stable build, and, you know, it was turning out really great pictures.
Mm.
A few things we had to watch out for with regard to, you know, the progressive scan, with regard to, you know, you get that jelly roll thing.
Oh, the rolling shutter.
The rolling shutter when you're doing really jagged handheld work and suddenly it's looking like it's wobbling around. So we just had to be mindful of that a little bit.
Mm.
But, you know, we thought that it looked terrific for what we were getting. But it was quite a gritty film. You know, District 9 is kind of semi-documentary and then it turns into a feature sort of halfway through. And it had that kind of sensibility about it that suited the Red incredibly well.
Yeah.
I mean, Reds now are like, you know, the quality's so high, and I don't think Mortal Engines is a gritty film. Mortal Engines is a glossy film, and that was on the Red weapon, and, you know, it looked fantastic. You know, it's a really rich, you know, capture. And when you're working in a RAW format, you've got so many options in post to play with regard to colour and with regard to contrast.
And as well as the choice of camera, I think at least as big a factor now is the LUT.
Is the LUT you use is
very much like choosing your film stock.
Absolutely, yeah, and that's a, you know, that's something I'm still learning about. I mean, I've been using LUTs a lot for the last few years, but in terms of building my own, I generally tend to get a colorist to build my LUTs for me at the moment. But one of the skills I'm really interested in upskilling myself on is how to build my own LUTs and resolve and apply them. So I love the use of LUTs because suddenly you can give a director and a producer a really clear idea about which direction you're planning to go. So when you're shooting on set, you can be really seeing what your intention is in the final thing, and so it makes it much easier than looking at a standard Rec 7 or 9 or you know, or a log, for instance. You know, you show a producer log and they get really confused. They go, why is it so milky? So it's like, you know, as a DOP I'm going, oh, I can see that and I can see that and I can see this. So I, for me, it's technically very useful to be able to look at log.
The other thing that I find really useful about LUTs is just the consistency of it. You've got that stable starting point.
That's right.
Kind of like a one light work print.
Exactly, it's a one light work print. Yeah. I mean, I did a show called Wanted a couple of just before Mortal Engines, with Rebecca Gibney instigated the show, and obviously they'd done a season here in Australia, and I was doing season two in New Zealand, and you know, I set up six LUTs for that because we had six different episodes with six different sort of locations. And we started with about, I know, 12 or 15 LUTs and then narrowed it down. So so the post house that I was working with, I wanted, you know, I got hooked up with the colorist from there, and we worked out some LUTs together. We would suit the different locations for the film, and then I presented those LUTs to the director, and they handpicked sort of the LUTs that they thought would be right for the film, and then we just stored them in the Alexa. We were shooting Alexa Minis. And we just stored them in the Alexa Minis and we just dialed them up as we needed to, you know. And it was fantastic because both producer and director could sit on set and go, oh, that's how we want it to look.
Yeah.
Or can we have a look at this LUT instead and see if that works better? And sometimes you'd change your LUT because that's kind of what worked for that scene.
That process of designing the LUTs can be an incredibly creative process.
It can be. You know, usually there's a pressure of time because, you know, if you're not doing it yourself, then there's the cost of actually hiring someone in the suite to do it.
Yep.
I think if you're doing it yourself at home, there's an incredible flexibility there, which is really, really good. But, you know, it's still just, as you say, it's a functioning one LUT. It's a one-light work print here. I think there's still a certain amount of caution I would exhibit when it comes to shooting with LUTs because you don't want to go so extreme that you're losing track of what you're actually capturing.
Yes.
And when I'm on set, I'm always punching between the LUT and my log to have a look and see what's actually being captured to make sure it's not throwing itself out. Yeah. Because you can sort of get up the garden path if your LUT's too extreme a little bit.
Yeah. Yep.
So I'm always, you know, looking at both. I'm looking at both to see what I'm capturing and then what's actually looking like on screen. It's one of the things between the Red and the Alexa camera that's different. You know, in the Red camera, you've got this fantastic RGB histogram at the bottom of the frame, which is out of the frame itself.
Yeah.
Where I'm looking, you know, I can be watching the monitor. I'm watching the viewfinder all the time, but at a glance, I can see what the histogram's doing. So I can see what my bottom end's doing in terms of blacks. I can see what my top end's doing.
Yeah.
Am I any of my traffic lights being struck? You know, traffic lights being the RGB warning that you're kind of trying to blow out a certain color channel.
Yep.
And so being able to see that at a glance, I love. You know, the Alexa's got, obviously, you can punch up waveforms and you can look at false colour, which is also really great as well.
Yeah.
But I really like having a screen where the image itself is not being interfered with by my exposure monitoring process.
Yeah, yeah. Well, one of the other things about the shift to digital is people got this intense fear of blowing out highlights.
Mm.
A lot of the time, of course, it is very sensible to be very protective of the highlights. It's interesting to me how relatively early that the actual problems with that got solved, and yet there's been this kind of lingering fear about it, in the sense that people would have never hesitated about blowing out highlights on film in the right circumstance.
That's right. You know, and it's like, you know, film had a sort of a creamy way of breaking into white that was sort of organic. Because it's a mechanical, chemical kind of process.
Mm.
And there's, you know, I ran into a filmmaker recently who was like, had thought about the process of film and thought, it's a kind of magic because it's all mechanical, chemical. It's like, there's nothing digital about it at all. And he was kind of astonished by the kind of magic that goes, that is he associates with film.
Yeah.
So film had always had that kind of organic roll off into white. You know, you're right, the early video stuff, especially because I grew up on BBD cam when I first started.
Right. Yeah.
And so blowing out highlights, you know, it was always ugly. When you hit that white and suddenly there's that edge.
It's an awful transition.
And it's then you just see it and you go, ugh. But you're right, they did solve that problem fairly early on. And, you know, when I was doing District 9, there was some pretty clear instructions from post, you know, don't blow out your highlights. And that was my first digital film, so I was a bit confused because my meter and what my images were telling me different things about where I should be exposing. Because traditionally on film, you would never underexpose too much. And and digital, of course, you could underexpose far more than you would dream of doing on film. You know, you got seven stops under. And, you know, on film, three and a half stops, four stops, you're all over. So, you know, I had a little bit of time being confused on District 9 about what my meter was saying, what I was seeing. But there were certain scenes in District 9 I did have to blow out. Like there's a scene, I don't know if you've seen it, but there's a scene when the dropship crashes and the bad guy comes in with his gun to get Charlton and take him off. And when he comes into the dropship, we shot that in the stage in Wellington and we didn't shoot it on location.
Mm.
And so I had nothing but a stage, you know, the wall of the stage outside the door.
Yeah.
So I just put up a big sheets of poly up against the door outside and blasted HMIs into it.
Wow.
And I had to blow it out because I didn't blow it out, you'd see all the ripple of the poly. Yeah. So that was an example of where I was deliberately blowing out the whites in order to create the magic of believing that we're actually outside.
Yeah. That process of creating custom LUTs, it's almost like being able to go into the old Kodak laboratories and get them to make a custom film stock for you.
You know, so that flexibility wasn't there in the days of film, you know. It's like you had chose a stock, and I think the closest I came to, you know, obviously there's Bleach Bypass and there was, you know, the amazing things that Darius Conji did with like Seven, where he was like, it's, you know, incredible, doing a silver bypass as well and putting the silver back in so the blacks were super rich. And everyone was tremendously excited about that, except the studio, I think, who had a very expensive process for prints. And I remember seeing a digital transfer years later where they obviously hadn't taken that look into account. And could see blue starting to turn up in the background, HMIs and things. And I was like, that's not the Seven I know. Because I saw it in the movie theater and I was like astonished at, you know, that kind of silky kind of blackness that was in those prints. It was just amazing.
Yeah. Incredible.
But generally, you know, and certainly in New Zealand filmmaking, the money was not really there to play around with that work. If you wanted to do a bleach bypass, that was quite a big deal. Because you're taking over the lab, you're stopping the lab from processing anything else while you're doing that thing. And I think the very first film I shot, I did a forced process. It was a black and white film. And the director was Nikki Caro. It was her first film. She was doing a master's degree, and it was her master's degree sort of film. And she wanted to kind of a German expressionist feel for the film. And so we were taking the stock and pushing it, I think, two stops, you know, which gave me a lot more exposure on set, so I didn't have to light it as hard. It also gave this incredibly separated, you know, almost the black and blacks were blacks and whites were whites, and there was not much grey in between, so it was a really extreme look.
Yeah,
and we loved it. It was great, but, you know, it was my first film, so I was a bit nervous. We did a 20-foot test, you know, which lasted about, you know, a few seconds because that's all we could afford. It was our 3-to-1 ratio film, so 20 foot was all we could afford to test with. Sent that down to the National Film Unit in Wellington. Got the result back, liked the result, but because our run was, you know, this pushed version, they couldn't process our rushes until they had enough footage to make it viable. So we shot the entire film without seeing any rushes at all.
Wow.
It was only a short film, but it was like a week shooting and we never saw any rushes. Then we sent it down, got it processed and got it sent back up. So my first viewing the rushes was extremely nerve-wracking because the film was done and dusted, the set was wrapped and we hadn't even seen rushes to see if it was clear or not.
That was very gutsy.
Well, it was what it was.
There is something about with the shift from film to digital, because of the quality of monitoring we have now on set, and the fact that you can see it in real time with great clarity, and there's not that separation between shooting and then sitting in rushes and seeing the footage that you talked to earlier about the magic of the process of film, and there's an extension of that magic in what the cinematographer does, where it used to be something that only the cinematographer who's looking at the light readings and has the image in their head really kind of knows what is going to be seen in rushes. Mm. Everyone else has to kind of trust that magic. And I think there's an element of that has been lost with the switch to digital, where everyone can kind of poke their head in and look at the monitor and have an opinion.
Yeah.
Do you feel you have to manage that in any way?
Well, if I'm doing my job properly, hopefully not. I mean, in the old days of film, it was like this black box magic thing, you know, where the DOP is doing something. We don't know how it's going to look. We've got the video split here if you're lucky, but in a bit, everything looks different to how it's going to look on film.
Much.
And as a DOP, you're doing it by numbers, really. You're just looking at your meter and you're calculating it. Oh, I want this a stop and a half under, or two stops under, or three stops under. So you sort of, it's calculating in your head what you've known those stops over and under look like. You know? And when I first started on film, you know, it took me a while to realize that, you know, getting something to look white on screen was going to be three stops or, you know, two and a half, three stops over before it would actually start to look white. So, because, you know, it was looking at mid-gray. So, you know, there was a learning curve there that was based all around calculation. And so sometimes it was a bit nerve-wracking as a DOP when you wanted to push the boundaries of the bottom end and you wanted to sit down at three stops under and three and a half hops under, and it was like, ooh, can I go down there without getting into trouble, you know? So I love the fact that I can feel reassured when I'm looking at on the monitor now and I know what I'm getting. But you're right, that does invite opinion from everybody else. So suddenly every man and his dog has an opinion about how things should look. But it also means you can have a much more informed conversation with the director and the producer about whether you're achieving what they want on set. So there's no kind of tears later on.
Yep.
So, you know, if you're feeling fairly secure in yourself, then you shouldn't really be worried about it. I do remember that some DPs used to use their light meter as a way of avoiding talking to the producer sometimes. So, you know, you'd see the producer coming and you pull your meter out and start looking really serious. And they'd leave you alone because you're doing your black magic. And you don't really do that these days. So.
Do you still use a meter at all?
Yeah, of course. Certainly I use it for green screens. So I was using it all through Mortal because I'm always measuring to see, you know, you're trying to give the post-production guys a pretty even screen if you can because you don't want to cause some trouble. So, you know, I'm trying to get the screen within a quarter of a stop or a third of a stop across the range. And you can sort of see where you're going out and where you're not.
The other thing I love about working with a meter is just the repeatability of it, that you can kind of go, okay, well, I know that the fill side was three stops under on that scene. It worked really well. So you can replicate that precisely.
Yeah, exactly. I tend to use a spot meter now more than an incident meter.
Yeah.
I'll pull the incident meter out occasionally, but I can generally look at the waveform monitor and kind of tell off the waveform monitor what I'm doing rather than actually have to walk across the set and take a meter reading.
Yeah.
Color meter readings are kind of a bit more essential now that LEDs are out. But, you know, we're still working off the image as well. So it's much faster to work off a monitor image than to go through the whole process of metering. But that said, you know, it's just another tool in the in the bucket. You know, and I still have the meter on me and I still pull it out and I use it fairly regularly, and it's it's still a great tool. I actually have a little meter on my phone as well, which I use sometimes if I'm at, you know, it's quite an accurate meter and it's just acting like a, you know, it still gives me a rough idea of what I'm doing. I wouldn't use it for like intense green screen work, but it's good as a general sort of idea. I'm quite interested actually in the apps that are available for DOPs at the moment. So
there's some good ones out there.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I use the standard ones like the Artemis and Sunseeker and those sorts of things. But I'd be really interested to actually have a bit of a session with other DOPs to find out what everyone's using. Do you have particular
Sunseeker? Apps?
Use Sunseeker all the time. Yeah.
It's amazing.
Yeah. And Artemis, I use quite a bit. You know. If you haven't got a viewfinder on you, can pull Artemis out and look at the lens that you're using on the body, and that's really useful.
I remember, I forget what the app was called on the computer on the Mac that where we used to get the, like, you'd put in all the information for the solar plotting and print out the sheets. I used to take those to Recce's and have the, you know, the inclinometer and the compass and you go,
exactly.
And now with Sunseeker, it's just like, boom, there it is. That's where it's going to be on that day. And,
it's really useful,
There's a shoot I did a few years back where we had a helicopter landing and we planned about a month in advance to have the helicopter landing on this sand dune at dawn, and we lined up so we'd have the helicopter landing and then the sun rising behind it. And we were able to plan it all out. The camera's going to be here, the helicopter's going to land there, the sun's going to be there a month in advance. And then we got there on the day and boom, there it was.
Exactly. Bang, it landed
exactly what it said.
Good that it wasn't an overcast day.
Yeah, that's right.
Don't be overcast, please don't be overcast. There's a really great New Zealand music video that came out a couple of years ago called Glare by a band called Sheepdog and Wolf.
Yeah.
And they shot that out in the Aussie Outback and with like, I don't know, a 2,000mm lens. It was like this massive long lens. And they just had someone, the whole video starts in darkness. And you can just make the outline of someone running towards you, but it's such a long lens that it looks like they're standing still while they're running. And then gradually the shimmer happens behind them and then you're going, what the hell's going on? And suddenly you realise it's the sun coming through all this atmos just rising right behind. And it must have been such an accurate, they had such an accurate lineup of where the sun was going to arrive. I don't know how you could do that with that software. It was like so bang on the money.
Wow.
And the whole video clip is just this guy running towards the camera with the sun rising behind him.
Wow. Here's another thing that would be good to talk about is the different sensor sizes. Mm.
There's so many different sizes now that you actually do need to program into your Artemis or whatever. Because you don't use a standard 35mm rangefinder and, you know, it's not going to be accurate for some of the chips you're working with. You can get caught out, you know, and it's like, and now they're bringing out like anamorphic lenses that have different squeeze rates according to what size sensor you got. So I still find it a bit confusing, to be honest, and I need to do my research on that. I can't really, don't think I can answer a question there without sounding ignorant.
I think there is something wonderful about the Super 35 format still. I think it's very well suited to telling motion picture stories.
Yeah. I mean, there was a big burst when the DSLRs came on the scene and they could record HD, you know, when the 5D came out and suddenly every man and his dog was doing, you know, like super shallow depth of field because they're working with a full gate.
One eyelash in focus.
Exactly. And they're doing, you know, that became really hip for like about 10 years. Yep. Probably it's still trending in there.
Yep.
And, you know, and it's like, and you looked at that, you looked at the 35mm and, you know, the standard 35mm motion picture, and that's a much smaller gate size than the 5D. And you're going, oh, crikey, you know, it's like, were we really working with that depth of field before on 35mm motion picture film? So it's like, it really comes down to what you get used to more than anything else. But I love the 35mm, the Super 35mm format's great.
Yep.
You know, I think the large format cameras are going to be a big deal in the next, you know, they already are starting to become a big deal and they do have a beautiful look.
It's a great option to have. It's a great choice to have available.
Yeah, it's kind of the dread of focus pullers because you know, the larger format you go, the longer the lens you need to have to create the same field of view.
Mm.
And the longer the lens you have, the shallower your depth of field is depending on what stop you're running at.
Yep.
And so, you know, focus pullers these days are sweating blood because the sensors are so sharp.
Mm.
And the field, you know, and the depth of field is so shallow. Sometimes, you know, they've got all their monitors cranked up for extra peaking so that they can see absolutely where the focus is sitting, whether it's sitting on the front of the eyelash or the back of the eyelash.
Yeah.
And, you know, and I think that's a bit, you know, it's a bit hard on focus pullers sometimes. And so,
and it's not necessarily. I mean, it can be such a beautiful look, and it can be such a powerful storytelling tool.
Mm.
But it's not necessarily appropriate for anything. And I think there's this kind of automatic thing at the moment where it's kind of an automatic expectation that everything will be shot wide open.
I know, but it's like, you know, you look at a film like kind of The Revenant or Citizen Kane, you know, where they have massive depth of field.
Yep. And they worked so hard to get it.
They're such beautiful films. And, you know, you've got the background person and a foreground person and everything sharp as a tack.
Yeah.
And it's a very special look.
Mm.
And, you know, I think that's going to actually come back into fashion quite a bit too. Yeah, I mean, a really deep depth of field is going to be huge as well. So suddenly we'll be like, piling heaps of light in to try and get our stop down so we can get a deep enough depth of field.
The Revenant's an interesting one in terms of the digital versus film thing because I saw that, I think it was about a week apart from The Hateful Eight in 70mm.
Right, which is 70mm, yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, both big scenes in the snow and the amount of detail and texture in the snow in The Revenant versus the in the 70mm film, in The Hateful Eight, was, I thought it was really quite a stark difference from what used to be one of the big weaknesses of digital, so, you know, shooting these wide, you know, big expanses of white. And it really struck me how much more there was there in The Revenant.
Mm. Yeah, I didn't feel like they're quite different film style-wise, totally. You know, and it's like in some ways The Hateful Eight I found quite of almost like an antiquated kind of style of shooting. It felt like everything was like, it was such a big format that they'd just sit on a mid-two shot for like 5 minutes while they had a conversation, which is fine. But, you know, I kind of got a little bit fatigued. Not fatigued, but I kind of got a little bit restless with that slowness of style. It was a very deliberate thing. With The Revenant, I thought, I mean, I liked The Revenant very much as a film. I thought it was a really brilliantly put together film. And I like the detail that we're seeing in the modern digital cameras. I don't feel like I need to go back to 70mm to get that kind of detail.
No.
But it's so long as the detail, so long as people don't push that detail so hard that we start to lose the sense of cinema. Again, there's my bugbear about things looking too sharp. And I do think there's a tendency for people to oversharpen things in post these days. Or actually the televisions themselves, the 4K TVs are now...
Well, there's so much of that happening.
They come prepackaged with a certain sharpness built into them so that you feel like you're getting your bang for buck with your 4K. And I just look at it and I go, that sucks. And I just go into the menu and I try and find a way to wind the sharpness down so I can get back to my cinema again.
Yeah, yeah. I remember seeing an American friend post on Facebook last year at Thanksgiving. He said, "It's Thanksgiving, everyone. Time to go home and retune your parents' TV sets."
It's fabulous.
Turn all the sharpening off.
Yeah. I saw a sort of a plea from, was it Tom Cruise and, you know, when he was doing Mission Impossible.
That's right,
it was like, you know, saying, can we please have the, you know,
motion smoothing.
God, can we just turn that stuff off? Because, you know, it's ruining the sense of... you know, of that motion blur. But, you know, again, that sort of slightly jagged, you know, slightly sort of stuttery thing that goes with the motion blur of a 24-frame film is actually bothers some people enormously.
Yeah.
You know, there was that big hoo-ha when The Hobbit came out at 48 and some people liked it and some people didn't like it, you know, and the 48 frames had the effect of sharpening the blur to the extent that, again, people felt like it was too sharp and a little bit video-y. It was a really interesting experiment, and I think that... Pete was doing it probably because he wanted to get the brightness up on a 3D. He wanted to really get the brightness up on the on the 3D image because, you know, you obviously lose a lot of light in the 3D through the 3D separation process. So I thought it was a really bold thing to do. And, you know, I don't know if he's going to go back to it again, but it was a really interesting experiment. And it was interesting to see where people sat on that.
Yeah, yeah. It's I've got a couple of theories on that. One is that I think there's actually something psychological. It's not just tradition, but there's something psychological goes on with 24 frames a second or anything in that area. That it's there's a psychological cue that this is one step removed from actual reality. Because once you get up to, you know, 48, 50, 60 frames a second as a playback speed, it's very, very close to the refresh rate of our eyes. So it's kind of that subconscious clue that what you're seeing is not actual reality. And I believe that that actually contributes to the suspension of disbelief.
Having the refresh rate at the right speed. So you like 24, you're saying?
I
think 24 feels about right to my eyes.
I think it helps with that process.
Yeah, like if I take my hand and I wave my hand in front of my eyes, I can see what kind of motion blur I'm getting between my fingers.
Yeah.
And it feels pretty much on the 24-frame mark, you know? If I look at any more Frozen and it starts to feel a little bit like it's fake.
Yeah.
For sure.
Yeah.
I don't mind it with slow-mo. You know, you take something and you're slowing it right down 120 frames and you want everything to be in focus anyway. So it's not a deal there. But with real-time movement, I kind of want to see it at 24 frames.
There's also the thing of I can understand how things like a battle scene would work better with higher playback frame rates. And I wonder whether there's potential for, with, you know, with the digital cinema formats, to actually make playback frame rate a variable within the process, so you could actually go...
You mean actually in the cinema when you're watching it, you actually change the frame rate according to...
Yeah, because I know like Apple are doing that with their iPads now. They'll change the refresh rate of the display.
Oh, really?
On the high-end iPads. It'll detect the frame rate of the content and adjust the frame rate to suit it. So if you're watching a film at 24 frames a second, the iPad screen will actually be refreshing at 24 frames a second. But if you're... playing a game that's rendering at 100 frames a second, it'll go to that.
Wow, that's cool.
And there's something about that, you know, if you had that as a variable in the creative process and you could be going, okay, well, we're going to shoot this action scene at 60 frames a second, not as off speed, but as 60 frames. And then this romantic scene we're going to shoot at 24. And I think it could be quite an interesting...
It's a really cool idea.
Another layer
to it.
Because so much of what we do is... subconsciously influencing the audience because they just kind of take what's there on screen as that's the reality of that world.
Yeah.
And we're giving them all these subtle subconscious clues with colour and contrast and all that sort of stuff about how to interpret that
movement
and what's going on.
And choice. All those things are all about subtly influencing the audience psychologically. I think it's a great, that would be a really interesting new tool to use.
Yeah.
You know, obviously, you'd have to program some kind of metadata in so that if you were shooting an off speed sequence, it knew it was an off speed sequence.
That's right. Yeah.
To leave it alone.
Yeah.
And I can see how that could be a really useful device, especially when you're dealing with the real and the unreal.
Yeah, exactly.
I think it could be a really good tool.
Yeah. It is a very exciting time in terms of the expanding palette of tools that we've got to use in terms of doing those subtle subconscious things to communicate with the audience on a creative level.
Yeah, my hesitation is that those technical tools don't become the obsession.
Yes.
That my obsession is still always with story.
Yeah.
And at the end of the day, I'm reading the script and I'm going, how do I want to feel in this scene, and what's the emotional temperament, and where do I want to draw the audience's eye in this shot? You know, what are they supposed to be looking at in this frame? And as you say, traditionally we'd used shadow, light, movement. You know, the first thing an audience will spot is movement.
Yep.
And the second thing they'll spot is what's the brightest thing in the frame.
Yeah.
So, you know, you're always drawing the audience's eye using where your bright spots are and where your movement is. And but, you know, they're just a tool to get us back to story. And, you know, I see a lot of people these days who are very technically obsessed. And at the end of the day, that doesn't really... It's not really the focus. The focus is all
about
narrative.
It's a means to an end.
Yeah, the focus is narrative, and I never want to lose sight of the fact that narrative is kind of the key to everything when it comes to storytelling.
And that essentially is the heart of cinematography.
That is the heart of cinematography, is telling stories visually. And in fact, you know, it's kind of a privileged place to be as a cinematographer because, you know, visual language is probably the predominant language on the planet. You know, anyone can understand a visual language. Anyone can watch a film and understand what it's about if they're watching a visual storytelling process.
Yeah.
You know, silent films were a case in point. Anyone can watch a silent film in any country and understand what's going on.
Mm.
And I think that's a really, you know, on a planet where everyone's language is different in terms of the politics and you know, and the regions, having a common language that everyone can understand is a really powerful tool.
Yeah. On that note, thank you, Simon.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.